all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome back to Veterans Radio Dwight S. Mears. Dwight is a retired Army major. He was commissioned after going to West Point as an aviation background, but along the way he picked up his PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a JD from Lewis and Clark Law School, and is working on his master's in library science. Dwight, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when we were on last, and folks can find this interview as well on our website at veteransradio.net in the podcast, we talked about internment of U.S. airmen in Switzerland. But you've also done a lot of research and writing on the evolution of the Medal of Honor, and I thought it would be very interesting to have some discussion about that. Let's start with, as an Army major, how did you get yourself interested in sort of the history of the Medal of Honor?
Well, it stemmed from my earlier research that I talked to you about last time with the Prisoner of War Medal. And because we effectively had no other service or valor medals until World War I, if you want to understand the statutory and to an extent policy history of other medals or provisions that are borrowed, you have to go to the granddaddy of all medals, which is the Medal of Honor. And valor awards, in particular, are tied to combat. And because the award that I was interested in was also a combat prerequisite award, the Prisoner of War Medal, I had to understand where the language came from in that medal in order to understand the combat thresholds, which were prerequisites before you could even be considered for a combat medal. You had to satisfy those legal criteria.
Well, before we get into some of the predecessors to the Medal of Honor, let me try to have you explain to our veteran radio listeners, because we get this question all the time, is it the Congressional Medal of Honor or the Presidential Medal of Honor?
It's just the Medal of Honor. So there is a, I guess you could say, misperception that it's called the Congressional Medal of Honor, and that certainly is a colloquialism that's out there. However, the authorizing statutes from the Civil War, and just about every statute subsequent to that, all used authorize a Medal of Honor in the name of Congress. And so really, because the executive, in this case the president, now awards the medal, and before the turn of the century, it was just the Navy or the War Department that awarded it. It really isn't the Congressional Medal of Honor in this sense that, just like any other law, Congress merely controls the criteria. They do not control the adjudication of the medal. And so it would be a mistake to say that it's actually awarded by Congress in the same way as a Congressional Gold Medal, for example, which is actually awarded by Congress. They have to pass a joint resolution in order to earn that medal.
And now we go back in time. There were a number of precursors to the Medal of Honor, today's the modern, if you will, Medal of Honor. One of them is the Fidelity Medallion, another was a Certificate of Merit medal that was issued. Talk to us a little bit about sort of those early attempts to put some recognition out for valor on the way to developing the concept of the Medal of Honor.
Right. Well, there were some precursors, and the Continental Congress started authorizing what later became congressional gold medals during the Revolution. At that time, it was mostly for general officers to commemorate victories, and so they went for the Battle of Saratoga or George Washington's defense of something, and so they would commemorate an event and a person, and eventually that grew into broader recognition, and so now civilians receive congressional gold medals, but they don't have actual military significance. Those are not, technically speaking, military awards, and they're also not worn, and so they're not military awards in the modern understanding. And it's important to understand that the United States, in its infancy and even for the first century of our existence, were a bit reluctant to authorize these awards because of the tradition in Europe, and overlap in many cases between military awards and aristocracy, because a lot of militaries were not necessarily, they weren't all volunteer forces, and they were often, you know, purchase commissions. There was a lot of overlap between aristocracy and control of the military in a lot of these countries. And so the biggest awards often went to royalty. And as a consequence, because the United States had made a clean break from that, it was seen as not very egalitarian to copy something that had this tradition of, you know, not benefiting the common man in Europe, even though most European militaries had very robust military awards traditions. And we ended up copying them later by World War I, predominantly because when we fought alongside them as allies, it was seen as a potential morale killer to be fighting alongside other forces in the trenches doing the exact same thing, sometimes even under their command, potentially, like U.S. forces fighting under French control in World War I, but not necessarily eligible for decorations. And so even all the way up until the 20th century, it required a waiver by Congress to even accept a foreign military award because of the potential to violate the Constitution. Because we have there's actually an explicit prohibition for titles of nobility, and that was until more modern times interpreted to include military awards by foreign governments because of the potential for, you know, Great Britain to grant a knighthood or something like that. The Constitution was actually seen as prohibiting military awards, at least from other countries. And so that very much delayed our own tradition right from the get-go.
In very broad strokes, you know, George Washington at the founding of the country wasn't a fan of these kind of awards. And we go 100 years and we get to the start of the Civil War. And in fact, I guess Abraham Lincoln signed into law a bill that restricted a certain number of medals of honor. Can you talk about what happened at the time of the Civil War?
Right. Well, there were a couple of medals that preceded the Civil War. And actually, Washington initiated one unilaterally during the Revolution. That was the badge of military merit. What is claimed to be the Purple Heart today, although it really isn't, because the Constitution didn't yet exist, there was no prohibition at that time to establishing a military award. And so Washington did it on his own authority. And when they were looking to expand the military decoration system in the 1930s, Douglas MacArthur, who was the Army Chief of Staff, saw that earlier medal that had fallen quickly into disuse as a way of circumventing congressional authorization. And so he claimed that he was resurrecting it as a way of not having to seek congressional authorization. And so that's why we call the Purple Heart the predecessor of the Badge of Military Merit. But in reality, it has very little to do with it. And so there was a short-lived decoration that was only awarded to, as far as we have any records, just a handful of soldiers near the end of the revolution. And then we didn't really have any military decorations until the Civil War, as you pointed out. And they did authorize a certificate of merit during the war with Mexico a few years prior to the Civil War. But that was just a piece of paper, and so that wasn't a medal that was worn either. They did convert it into a medal later, but that wasn't until the turn of the century that that happened. And so during the Civil War, there was nothing except this medal that was authorized. And in fact, the Certificate of Merit had lapsed by that time, so they couldn't even award that during the Civil War, because it was only authorized during the Mexican War, and it was resurrected later. But during the Civil War, until 1861, when they authorized the first statute for the Navy and 1862 for the Army, that was the very beginning. And even then, it was delayed by reluctance on the part of U.S. leadership to authorize these medals because of the aristocratic underpinnings. And so the commanding general of the Army actually had previously been asked about awarding medals, and he actually did not, Winfield Scott did not want to authorize a medal. Until he stepped down, the medal was effectively blocked by the War Department. And then it was authorized once he left, once he retired after the outbreak of war.
And does the modern Medal of Honor criteria trace its roots back to the time of the Civil War or the World Wars?
Well, I would say that the modern Medal of Honor was born from the Army in World War I. Now, they did obviously tack on the lineage earlier, these 1861 and 1862 authorizations. And so anyone that earned it, you know, in that earlier period, obviously could still wear it unless it was revoked, which nearly 1,000 were in 1917. And so they did recognize the earlier medals as equivalent to the modern medal. But from a legal standpoint, it was not. Primarily because there were no other medals. And so if you consider that we have, you know, any manner of service medals and valor medals and achievement medals today, the earliest medals of honor encompassed all of those awards. And there really were not any regulations that prohibited it from not being awarded for any of those reasons that you might get a very minor medal today for service, gallantry, or otherwise. In fact, combat was not even a prerequisite for the medal earlier on, even though it was authorized very specifically for the War of the Rebellion. It didn't necessarily get awarded only for that, and there were many cases where people were not actually in combat and received a perfectly valid medal.
And as you mentioned, I want to back up to it, you mentioned that they actually removed about 1,000 recipients off the Army's Medal of Honor list. Those awarded somewhere probably between 1860 and 1917, in that period, they were just given out for a lot of reasons that maybe didn't measure up. But can you talk to us why so many medals recipients were removed from the list?
Yes, well, so this review was only for the Army, and because it was requested by the War Department and to a lesser extent by the earlier precursor to what today is the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. At that time, it was the Medal of Honor Legion, and these Medal of Honor recipients were not particularly happy with the fact that, you know, all these so-called undeserving recipients were adulterating the perception of their awards. Because so, for example, there was an entire infantry regiment from Maine, 864 people that received the medal as an enlistment extension. They agreed to extend their enlistment to guard the Capitol, and most of them didn't actually remain to guard it, but the War Department sent them an entire trunk of 864 medals. and about two-thirds of them didn't actually do the complete the action that the citation claimed. And so for so-called bona fide Medal of Honor recipients, that was an egregious slight, even though the medal, the modern language, the gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty at risk of life with two eyewitnesses in no way existed at that time. Combat was not a requirement. Gallantry and intrepidity was not necessarily a requirement. And the above and beyond the call of duty language didn't even enter into regulations until after the turn of the century. And that later precluded awards for leadership that would today be recognized by a service medal. Because if the War Department eventually rationalized that if it was your duty to do something, if you were supposed to do it because that was your job or you were ordered to do it, which made it obligatory, then they ought not to be giving out their highest medal for it because failure to do it would actually open you to censure. And so if we're going to court-martial or punish you for failure to do something, then why are we giving you our highest medal for doing exactly what we're supposed to? After all, that's just your job.
And I think a lot of people would agree with that. But it's sort of interesting when you delve into this history, the degree of controversy and the degree of battles on what should and shouldn't be in trying to receive this award. I understand that after World War I, the Navy tried to break the Medal of Honor into sort of two versions, one combat, one non-combat. What was the thinking behind that and the outcome or ramifications of doing that?
Well, it's complicated, and I'll try to give you a very brief synopsis, but because there were different statutes for the Navy and the Army at that time, the services developed different award criteria because early on they didn't have much in the way of regulation. The Navy did publish regulations but did not really alter the material criteria in the statute, which were very broad. They basically authorized the award for just about anything, and so did the Army's. Now, the Army was distinct, though, because the Army published no regulations on the medal until the 1890s, and they only did so because it became a crisis for them. Once the award became popular, particularly in veteran circles, basically Union soldiers started requesting the award 30, 35 years later in the hundreds every year, starting largely in the 1890s, because they were starting to commiserate in these, Grand Army, the Republic reunion kind of get-togethers, and they saw people with the medal, and they wanted it. They realized that their comrades, and in some cases, performed actions that were no more meritorious than their own. They just simply had not been recommended for some reason. And so they started asking for it. And at that time, there was no statute of limitations. You didn't have to recommend within a certain number of years. You didn't have to award within a certain number of years. And there wasn't even an eyewitness requirement. And so some people just wrote into the War Department asking for the medal on their own affidavit. And many of those likely were fraudulent. And so it caused the War Department to go into crisis mode because they didn't know how to deal with it. And so they eventually wrote their first regulations in the 1890s, and by the turn of the century had very strict criteria that were substantially modern. Then they asked Congress by World War I to codify what was in their regulations, and then that ended up in the statute. But the Navy had developed an entirely different tradition, and so while the Army's tradition was largely in reaction to this policy vacuum, and ironically is exactly what produced the strict criteria of today, the Navy didn't have that. The Navy had regulations that were decentralized, but it still required, the Navy Department to sign off on the award. And so the Navy was more interested in recognizing altruistic actions that saved ships. And so they weren't necessarily focused on rewarding combat gallantry like the Army eventually gravitated to. The Navy, especially, after ships started sinking because of boilers exploding and magazines lighting on fire. If sailors went in and sacrificed themselves to save the ship, it didn't matter too much to the Navy that that might not have been incident to a combat situation. And so they wanted to preserve this ability to award the medal for any action that was altruistic enough that furthered the, you know, put the interests of the crew over the interests of the individual. And the Army's version of the medal eventually focused more on individual combat with the agency that an individual soldier might have in the trenches or on the battlefield.
So we should really look at those World War sort of II, Korea, Vietnam, and forward medals a little bit differently than the earlier medals that were given out by the services under various regulations. Would that be a fair statement?
Correct. In fact, the Navy's Medal of Honor could be awarded lawfully for non-combat actions until 1963, even though they had ceased doing that. They had attempted to award one as late as the Korean conflict and it had been overruled by the Secretary of Defense, but the statutory authorization remained. Until 1963, they had a very different medal. And arguably, it wasn't necessarily equivalent to the Medal of Honor, and that's not meant to impugn any of the legitimate recipients, of course. But as a matter of fact, it simply was not the Medal of Honor, and the Army's Medal of Honor was not the Medal of Honor until 1918, and that's just a legal judgment.
We're talking veteran radio listeners to Dwight Mears, PhD, retired Army major, deep into these legal issues on medals, and he wrote The Medal of Honor, The Evolution of America's Highest Military Decoration, and it is available on Amazon. As you've studied this, Dwight, talk to us a little bit about the perceived or inherent biases that the Medal of Honor has or hasn't been awarded to minority soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and the work that the Department of Defense has done in trying to justify or rectify, I should say, some of those actions?
Sure. Well, there's been a number of reviews starting really in the 1990s to retroactively look at whether or not discrimination had tainted awards, denied awards to deserving recipients. And the first review took place in the early 90s. The Secretary of the Army actually requested it. And so there was a team of historians that reviewed African Americans that had served in World War II. And the conclusion of that review produced a number of recommendations for upgrade based on lower awards that were not, you know, had not actually percolated up to become medals of honor for whatever reason. And then Congress passed a waiver of the statute of limitations that normally would have prevented those awards from being authorized, because you have to award them, you know, both recommend and award within a discrete period that's specified in the statute. And so that was the beginning of these retroactive reviews. And then in the late 1990s, constituents agitated for the same thing for Asian American and Pacific Islanders who had served in predominantly in the Army. And so that a similar review was performed for World War II veterans, and an even greater number of Medals of Honor were retroactively authorized from that review under President Clinton. And then starting in, I think it was 2001, they kicked off a review for, it was originally intended for Jewish Americans, and then it expanded to Hispanic Americans and even included some African Americans by the end. And that one did not have as much success. It took until 2014 for that one to culminate, largely because it had to be performed a couple of times before there was agreement on who would be upgraded. But there's not a lot of information on that one. And interestingly, no review of that type has been performed back to World War I for all ethnicities. And so I'm working with a group that is looking to authorize a retroactive review of that type for various ethnicities, but particularly African-Americans are seen as deserving. There have been a couple that have been upgraded that were never recommended initially at that time. Currently, I think there's only two, and they were basically lobbied as individual recipients, and so they received a waiver of the statute of limitations as a by-name bill passed for Congress, but they didn't actually review all the soldiers that served. And so that's what this task force that I'm working with is attempting to do.
Well, let me ask a final question here. And we're talking to Dwight Mears,
sure.
who's a historian, author, deep thinker on medals. Dwight, tell our Veteran Radio listeners why you think the issuance of the Medal of Honor is still a relevant medal today.
Well, as long as we have a military that's fighting, here overseas, it's relevant because it places, there's intense symbolism there. The original reasons that the military authorized this medal were largely for morale. And I don't think many people aspire to earn the Medal of Honor these days. And certainly many of the recipients I've heard wish that they had not earned it, because it usually means they went through a terrible experience and had a lot of their friends die. And in some cases they die. And that's not really something that most people aspire to, but it's relevant nonetheless, because the recipients become emblematic of this sense of courage and self-sacrifice that the medal eventually became associated with after we created these other medals that I didn't canvas exhaustively, but largely after World War I. And because we created these lower medals, it pushed the Medal of Honor very much up and out of reach from the regular soldier, and it becomes a rarity to be awarded it, for better or for worse, especially in the conflicts we have today, which are not, traditional battlefields, which make the opportunities to receive the medal even less. And so it is important because these people are inspiring, if not, because you're not necessarily trying to emulate the Medal of Honor winners in a literal sense. You're not going out and killing yourself every day, hopefully. But it, I think, for me, evokes a sense of putting the soldiers on your left and right, or sailors or Marines, whatever service you're in, they're more valuable than your own life. And so if you really buy into the ethos of the service, then the medal usually represents sacrificing yourself for your fellow man. And there is no higher sacrifice than that.
Well, I think that's an excellent place to bring this to conclusion. We want to thank you, Dwight Mears, for spending some time again with Veterans Radio to talk about the evolution of the Medal of Honor and its place still today in American society.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.